Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people who have different perspectives from me and talk about the Bible, God, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. And I include you in that comment because I really enjoy hearing what you think about these topics as well. If you've been listening to the last few episodes of Context Matters, you've heard me talk with scholars about the Bible and modern jazz. Last week, I talked with Ruth Naomi Floyd about Frederick Douglass. He was poetic, but also one who identified where humans have gone awry and calls them forth towards something better, something closer to what God designed for humanity. This sounds a lot like the prophetic imagination that Walter Brueggemann discusses in his book, well, called Prophetic Imagination. He talks about the ability of the prophet to confront the empire and to draw God's people closer to what God designs instead of what human empires design. And honestly, that sounds like something we still need. So I reached across the Pacific Ocean and into the Southern Hemisphere to talk with a scholar who has written on the prophet Jeremiah. He had a tough job and is sometimes called the weeping prophet. But in reality, it is not just Jeremiah. The book talks about the tears of God. And in that book, we see an emotional God. And in light of all of the jazz we've been talking about, Jeremiah was a prophet confronting injustice without having an immediate nor a happy outcome. And so Jeremiah seems to be a really good conversation partner in this little mini series that we're doing. I am so pleased Dr. Jill Firth and I could coordinate our schedules to have this conversation. Dr. Firth is a lecturer in Hebrew and Old Testament at Ridley College in Australia. I think she had a really interesting journey into professional biblical studies and then towards the process of focusing on the book of Jeremiah. So we are going to start there.
So I was born into a non-Christian family where God just wasn't an issue. We didn't ever pray. People didn't talk about God. But when I was quite young, actually, when I was, I know I was younger than eight because we moved house from the place where this happened. I used to go down to the bottom of the garden as a sort of regular thing. We lived in a big house with a big garden. And I used to meet this mysterious, invisible presence. I don't think we ever talked. He just felt he just was, and I just was. And it was just, you know, very safe place to be. But when we moved away from there, we were living on the east coast of Australia and we moved up to another city. I thought I'd left that person behind because it's like a fairy at the bottom of the garden. You move to a new garden, there's no fairy. But later, I was very interested in God though. And I used to ask all the kids, you know, when you're queuing for the bathroom, I remember when I was in about grade two and I asked a friend who was a Catholic, what do you know about God? And she told me about the Trinity, and that's still to this day the foundation of my understanding of the Trinity, this sort of 6 or 7 year old girl explaining the Trinity to me. That's amazing. I just kept on asking people who are religious, do you go to church? What do you know about God? Do you ever pray? When I was about 12, I learned my first prayer, which was, now I lay me down to sleep, which is not really a prayer for a 12-year-old, but I didn't know any others. At that time, I just asked some religious person, I say, well, I know this one. But then I became a Christian. And, you know, really gave my life to Jesus and started to follow him. I read the Bible because they told me to read a chapter every day and memorize a verse every day. So I did because I didn't know any better. It was great. I mean, I know lots of verses and I read the whole Bible quite quickly in the first couple of years. I was 12. So I guess by the time I was 13 or 14, I'd read everything and got into leadership in my church. Then I tried to go to Bible college, but they said I was too young. And then I got married. And it took me about 25 years to get back to Bible college. But in between, my husband was an ordained pastor, so we worked in churches, we worked overseas. And then eventually when we came back, I went back to the Bible college and said, hey, you told me I was too young before, what do you think now? And of course they let me in, and that's sort of been the last part of the story.
Huh. How did your family react to you? Did you even tell them about this mystical presence in the garden? And did they make this connection? And did you make this connection that that was the Holy Spirit, or that was a form of God's presence being with you and calling you? And so what did your family do with all of that?
So I don't think I told anybody about it. It was just like foundational, you know, that's what happened when you went down to the bottom of the garden. Yeah, I don't think I told them. And in fact, I forgot, because I moved away. I was only about eight, moved away from that house. And then I became a Christian, a kind of traditional, you know, manner, actually at a Billy Graham crusade, where they didn't ask me anything about mysterious presences at the bottom of the garden. They said, like, sign this here and say this prayer. But years later, you know, in prayer, I thought, I know you. You're the guy from the bottom of the garden. So it was kind of like a tremendous experience, because I'd grown up in this very not hostile atheistic, but just non-religious background, to think that God had been reaching out to me when I was very, very small. And I'd, you know, because I didn't know it was God, I didn't know to follow that up as a God thing.
Right.
But it kind of, the dots got joined later. I did tell them when I became a Christian, because if you go to Billy Graham, as most of you know, they say, go home and tell your family. So I went home, and my poor family, because my sister took me to this crusade. And when we got home, I said, well, I've got something to tell you. You know, I've just become a Christian. And they're, you know, like jaws dropped, because it wasn't part of our family tradition. And they told me later that they just thought it would wear off. Mm-hmm. And we were from that religious tradition, or the non-religious tradition, where people thought, we'll let them decide when they grow up, you know, like we won't force any view on them. So they just let me be a Christian, let me go to church, drop me to youth group things, whatever. And then later in life, when we were going to be missionaries, I said, look, I'm sorry about this, because we were taking the grandchildren away. How do you feel about that? And they said, oh, we thought you'd have gone long ago. So they kind of gradually adapted, you know, thinking it would wear off as a teenage thing. And it you know, obviously didn't. And that was very precious, actually. They're never hostile, always supportive, even though it wasn't something that they personally had embraced. Yeah.
Hmm. When did you gravitate towards Old Testament text? You're an Old Testament scholar now, primarily, and have done so much work in challenging texts, to be sure. When did you feel pulled into that type of literature?
So I guess I got quite involved in a healing ministry when I was in Hong Kong particularly, but also a bit before. And, you know, texts like the Isaiah texts, you know, the beautiful pictures of God, you know, healing people and stuff like that, that was very attractive to me. But I also like Jesus and, you know, stuff in Revelation about wiping away the tears. So I wasn't narrow-minded about the Old Testament, but just friendly. But really it was when I went to study at college, because I've been thinking about the Bible for a long time by then, most of the New Testament stuff was pretty familiar to me. But the Old Testament was like this magic, like I'd read the stuff, but I had no idea of all this glorious stuff that was in there. And then when I started to learn Hebrew, I thought, let's never go back, you know, to reading the Bible in English. So it just was probably quite a later in life thing to actually kind of specialize into the Old Testament and to see. I think that there's two things I like. One is God. I really like God in the Old Testament. You know, he's just so hands-on, and his glory and his kindness and all that stuff is just so fleshed out in the Old Testament. And the other thing is the people are experiencing the same nitty-gritty everyday things that we experience. Of course, they did in the New Testament, but they don't, you know, tell you all about that, because they expect you to read the Old Testament. But, you know, all the people suffering and crying out to God and feeling lost, you know, that's very thick in the Old Testament. It's very, very precious.
I relate to that in that when I was anti-Christianity for a while, part of my life, and as I came back towards it, I felt like the only people I could relate to were the ones in the Old Testament, because emotion was so raw. And I felt like, here are the people that have the same complaints that I do. and so that was also one of the things that drew me in quite significantly. Do you think that your time that you spent abroad, so you were in Hong Kong, I don't know if you were in other places as well, but did that also have a formative hand in what you thought about God and Bible?
I had three kind of distant experiences for me. So I grew up on the East Coast till I was sort of 19 or so. And then to get married, I went to the West Coast. And one of the placements that we had was in the country, in the rural area. which was like marginal land. They did grow wheat and they had sheep. It's sort of like wheat and sheep country. And I hadn't really had much contact with rural people. And I just, the amazing community and the way people cared for each other in practical ways, that was just so eye-opening. And it's so like the Bible, isn't it?
The
community, you know, they go out and they help. Somebody's header breaks down, so everybody goes and takes the crop off for them, or somebody's sick and they all go and do their shearing or something like that. So that was the first kind of like, wow, life through the lens of the urban dweller isn't all there is. And then we were going to work in Asia, but we had visa issues. So we spent some time on Groote Island, which is an Aboriginal. It's an island that is part of Arnhem Land, which is in the north of Australia, which is sort of set aside. Lots of Aboriginal things are protected there. So the just learning from Aboriginal people there again, that community thing, I mean, that was even deeper there. But also like about tribes, which to a urban dweller is like, well, tribes, you know, it's sort of like something out of a movie. Whereas to see the tribal life, and I mean, the Old Testament, those people were tribal people. So then you get all this idea of how that might work and different ways of doing just about everything. So that was absolutely fantastic. And then we went to Hong Kong, which wasn't our original destination, but through circumstances, that's where we ended up. And again, a totally different culture with just different ways of doing things. And it was a time under pressure in the culture there, and just seeing people responding to suffering and just putting the gospel first in a way that, again, some Western Christians aren't as sharp on putting all your money and all your time and all your love and all your energy, just seeing how God worked in that situation. And It was like New Testament church, you know, that's a bit of a cliche, but just seeing how that worked, I thought, oh, just so many dimensions that are in the Bible that I got more clue about, And empire, because the Chinese was a huge, historically, this huge sort of thing. So you could kind of think about, oh, that could be like the Babylonians or whatever,
That's so great. I remember someone, and this was several years ago, we were driving in the car and he turned to me and he said, do you think people who are persecuted have a better understanding of their faith? And I hadn't formulated it using those words before, but I thought, absolutely, they have to, because it's forced to mean something to them. Like what you were saying, that because of your circumstances, you give everything for faith. It is a whole different circumstance than what we're accustomed to.
That's right. Yeah. And we're also in the missionary community. So there were lots of rich missionaries who live better than ordinary people in Australia, but there are also very poor ones living by faith, or, you know, very grassroots with their communities. And that was a tremendous experience as well.
Now, when you went back to Bible college and then you went and pursued a PhD, you wrote on David, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so you wrote on David, but all of your recent work now is on Jeremiah. So what was the draw towards Jeremiah and away from David?
So I haven't actually gone away from David. I've just got a bit bogged with David. So I'm still writing my book based on my PhD, which may come out one day. But there's a short and a long answer. So the short answer is, when I was being offered my job at Ridley College, they said, well, Psalms is good, but you really need another string to your bow, you know, get another string to the bow. And someone who'd been at our college who left was Andy Abernathy, and he was the king of Isaiah. So I thought, I'm not doing Isaiah, because Andy's the king of Isaiah, and, you know, we've got him all taped and everything, like you can do electronic courses with Andy. So what would be the point of like scurrying along in his footsteps? But when he was with us, he taught a course on Jeremiah, and I was like his tutor. This is before I, you know, got to be faculty. And I just couldn't believe how the students were affected by Jeremiah. So, you know, the tears of God, and people were like, I didn't know God was like that. And it was just fantastic. So my choice was Jeremiah. But there is a link, because the work I did on the Psalms is with the question, why are there individual lament psalms with the David superscription at the end of the Psalter? Because people look at the whole Psalter and they say, well, you start with individual lament, mostly David, and you end up with corporate praise, mostly not David. So that's kind of a big paradigm in Psalms that people, you know, generally cite as an overview. But here are this group of eight Davidic psalms right near the end of the Psalter, 138 to 145, and the heart of them is laments. So I thought, well, this is so interesting. Why is David back? Why is he lamenting? You know, what is this? Why have we got the individual voice again? So that was a structural kind of question about looking at the whole of the Psalter. And Jeremiah is the perfect candidate for that task, because everybody's kind of very disagreeing about what the structure of Jeremiah might be, because it looks like a jumble. There's all kinds of ways of describing it that aren't very complimentary about it just being a bit of a mishmash. And then people have sort of seen some big picture things. But when I started to do some work and I thought, oh, perhaps it's this and perhaps it's that, and I got some different insights into what might be happening there. So my interest in big, messy books, that there's a bit a debate about what's going on, you know, that took me to Jeremiah. And I guess the lament was there as well, but more the big messy book. I love that kind of thinking about why is the book like this? You know, is it just a mess, or is there some, I think there's a rhetorical shape to the book. It's not like a logical, let's tidy up everything, but then the Psalms aren't tidy either. So,
right,
you know, why even if somebody was having a bad day and they were in exile and they didn't have much money or paper, why did they end up putting it together in this way rather than another way?
Yeah. Can you give us a little introduction maybe to the person of Jeremiah that we see depicted in the book, and then maybe your view of why the book is so helter-skelter and what the rhetorical question might actually be?
Yeah, so you might need to re-ask me the last bit, so I'll do sure. Jeremiah first. There's been a huge amount of debate about Jeremiah and his personality, and I know that you've read my chapter in the book, The Bible and Mental Health, where I was asked, so what's Jeremiah got to do with crushing depths of depression and darkness and stuff? So
it's,
I thought,
like,
well, just
everything.
Well, it's clearly everything. But then I thought, well, how have other people found it helpful? Because I'm just some small peanut in Australia. You know, they might care about what was helpful to me. But I thought, well, let's go and look at the great ones through history and see what they thought. So when I looked around, I found that John of the Cross had used Jeremiah, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer was very keen on Jeremiah, and Kazuo Kitamori, who's a Japanese person who was actually one of the early people to talk about the theology of the cross, you know, like God suffering, which we know through Moltmann, you know, that's another thread, but Kitamori was earlier in that. And then to look later at more recent scholars like Kathleen O'Connor, who uses Jeremiah for trauma. There are other people doing it, but she's one of the key figures. And Emmanuel Katangoli, who's an African-based scholar now working in the US, but who looks at how lament works, and then, you know, a whole lot of other people. So I just tried to read up on what people felt about Jeremiah. So he's seen in all different ways. Historically, some people thought, you know, he's this mighty figure striding through the land, and then other people say things like he was this timid little guy. Some people think that he was perhaps mentally not that well. There's a lot of, especially 20th century psychoanalysis of Jeremiah as a person whose, you know, mental health wasn't good. Some people think that Jeremiah firms up and strides through towards the end of the book, and others think that he's like ebbing away, so he's fracturing, and, you know, so it's quite varied, I think, the presentation or the readings of Jeremiah. But I when I think about Jeremiah myself, I just think it's so raw, you know, the presentation that he gives. I mean, we get David's rawness and we get Job's rawness. You know, there are other raw people in the Bible, and little bits of, you know, Hannah's rawness when she's wanting the child, and people whose story isn't thickly told, but, you know, Tamar surely felt terrible, and Jephthah's daughter. But we get this in, like, full, you know, pages of Jeremiah. It's very thickly spelt out, his total willingness to do God's will, but on the other hand, his terror, which is clearest in chapter 15, I think, where he says, you know, are you going to be to me like a deceitful brook?
Dr. Firth is referring to Jeremiah 15, in which Jeremiah and God have a conversation. You hear the frustration in God's voice for his people constantly rejecting him. And Jeremiah then says, O Lord, you know, remember me and visit me and take vengeance for me on my persecutors. in your forbearance, take me not away. Know that for your sake I bear reproach. Your words were found and I ate them, and your words became to me a joy and the delight of my heart. For I am called by your name, O Lord God of hosts. I did not sit in the company of revelers, nor did I rejoice. I sat alone because your hand was upon me, for you had filled me with indignation. Why is my pain unceasing, my wound incurable, refusing to be healed? Will you be to me like a deceitful brook, like waters that fail? Ah, the rawness in what Jeremiah says. And my bet is that you have felt the same way at some point too. The last verse is what Dr. Firth was talking about.
It's very thickly spelt out, his total willingness to do God's will, but on the other hand, his terror, which is clearest in chapter 15, I think, where he says, you know, are you going to be to me like a deceitful brook? And so some people translate that, you are to me like a deceitful brook. But I think the grammar allows you to think, are you going to be to me? Like, you've been good so far, but this is getting worse and worse and worse. They're trying to kill me. Everybody hates me. You know, you want me to say all these things, which nobody likes. And is it going to turn out that you're just going to like leave me in the lurch? That's really raw, isn't it? And spectacular. But in my reading of the Confessions, which is chapter 11 to 20, he kind of works through that so that he is still like so much darkness facing him, but he kind of comes to rest, you know, in God, though still lamenting, still protesting. He doesn't just say, oh, that'll be nice, okay, let's go. But he's like, this is really hard, but I believe you're going to be trustworthy and let's do it together. But the second half of the book, if you hadn't read the first half, you wouldn't know that he was through that trauma, that, you know, he's just moving around. People are trying to kill him and people are trying to betray him and, you know, spends the time in the pit and so on. And I mean,
typical Old Testament drama.
You know, when he's in the pit, he says, look, I could die here. So he's not like given up on making negative remarks. So I don't know whether he has come to a place of peace where he's just like moving in that confidence, or whether it's just like what he wrote in his diary compared with what, you know, how the narrative looks. Because in the Psalms, you think David spent all day crying. Whereas if you read Samuel, he's stomping around. I mean, he has got enemies, but it's not like the Psalms is the inside look and the, you know, Samuel's the mostly the outside look. So is Jeremiah the first half the inside look and the second half the outside look? Or did something happen that he shifted so he wasn't in that lament confession stage for the rest of his life? I don't know the answer, but I'm fascinated by how the book is constructed to give you the inside look before the outside look.
Yeah. What do you think of, because usually any of us who teach biblical studies hate the cherry pickers for things, but I find it particularly grievous when people go straight to Jeremiah 29:11 or the chapter of 29, because I feel like there is so much trauma that is happening. There's so much weeping. There's so much conflict. And the only thing I hear people, and they tell me this all the time when I talk about the exile, and they're like, oh, but God said he'd bless them in the exile. Almost like Jeremiah had this positive message for them to go into the exile and sow their seeds and create their gardens and God would bless them. And I don't know, do you have as strong or stronger or maybe less strong of a reaction to that? Because the Jeremiah you just described doesn't sound like the Jeremiah of chapter 29. And so we're missing something if that's the only thing we focus on.
I think we're missing two things. One is that nice promise is in 70 years' time. So the people who are alive hearing the promise are not the people who are going to see the good plans come to fruit. And most people, I mean, I'm not going to live 70 more years, and I'm trying to look at you to think if you possibly will. But, you know, you might be 100 or something. But You know, if I heard, well, you're having a terrible time now, but, you know, your grandchildren will have a good time. That's a good promise to a Jew. That's a fantastic promise. But to a Western person, that's, you know, I want it next week. I don't want to wait. You know, I don't want to die in misery. And, you know, so I think that there's just a little bit of lack of context there. And the other thing I think that is just really important reading Jeremiah is that there are two groups in Jeremiah. There's this group that have gone to exile, which seems really bad, but actually this is God's rescue plan for the Jews, because Nebuchadnezzar is a huge empire. If we think ISIS stomping all over the globe, and the only safe place actually is the eye of the storm in Babylon, because he's stomping near where he lives, and then he stomps all the way to Egypt. You know, he's stomping everywhere. So the only place to get out of the whirlwind is to be in the eye of the storm. So God amazingly says to the people, okay, you know, I'm going to pop you in here for 70 years. Doesn't look so good, but actually it's like going into the bunker, you know, into the air raid shelter. I don't know what the American equivalent is, but, you know, British people had all the bunkers in the war. He puts them in the bunker, which is not that great, but it's better than being out in the air raid. But the other people who refuse to surrender, and there's a whole conversation around that that's my most interesting, you know, thing I'm grappling with at the moment. But some people won't surrender, including the king Zedekiah, who's the one who's left after the guys go into exile. And he's like, no, we're not going to surrender. No, we're just, you know, going to do our best. And he says, you guys are like bad figs, you know, rotten, stinky figs that no one can eat. You're revolting and you've really gone bad. So there's two groups there, you know, the ones who are kind of in the bunker, which isn't that nice, but with a promise that they'll get out one day, and others who have just determined to stand outside while the bombs are dropping on them. And I mean, that's the whole story of the middle of Jeremiah, and in fact, you know, the whole second half, and in fact, the whole book, that you've got to make a choice. Are you going to let God put you in the bunker for a little while, or are you just going to stand out there and let the bombs drop on you and be decimated, which is what happened to the people who didn't go to Babylon. Yeah.
Mm. Why? I'm kind of fascinated by this new fascination of yours. There's a paper coming out of that soon, I hope, or another book.
There's a whole book coming. I'm writing a commentary.
Okay, great.
Lots of things coming. Yeah.
Not only that, but, you know, and I try not to make the immediate connection from the ancient world and ancient context to our own, but they're, and especially a very privileged kind of Western context, which is definitely not the same as the Israelites being stomped on by Babylon. But the idea is sometimes people get so stubborn and they don't let God really reach into the circumstance and be disruptive but protective at the same time.
Yeah, God's answers were just so wrong. You know, like he says, the people who go out and surrender to the Babylonians will receive their lives as a prize of war. That's a general promise. It's not just to Ebed-Melech, who's the guy who gets Jeremiah out of the pit, which is a well-known story. It's not just to Baruch, who's his scribe, though it's made personally to him, but it's made to Zedekiah and generally to the people in Zedekiah's time in chapter 21 and 37 and, you know, repeatedly made. But you've got this huge, terrible, cruel empire descending upon you. And the stupid prophet Jeremiah says, you know, God wants you to go out and surrender to these guys and it'll be really good. Right. And they're like, no, we got to fight. You know, you're joking. This is the evil empire. And, you know, we're God's chosen people and we have to fight back and he'll help us. And Jeremiah's like, no, you've got to surrender to the evil empire. And I mean, that must have been so hard to hear. You know, the few people, we read that some people did go out because Zedekiah was afraid of the people who'd gone out. So some people did that. But how weird, you know, to be God's people and told to, you know, lay down your arms and walk out into the arms, not the gun arms, but the loving arms or the non-loving arms of the Babylonians. And then, you know, in chapter 40, after because they don't, you know, most people don't walk out, so they have the destruction of Jerusalem. And then the person who's the official of Nebuchadnezzar comes and he says, Nebuchadnezzar's got his eye on you and I've got my eye on you and you can go wherever you like. You know, the whole land is before you, quoting Abraham basically. And then they appoint this governor who's a good person and he says, you know, come and live in the land and things will go well with you. So, you know, there's another shift there, unexpected. You know, you'd expect the Babylonians just to do like torture and chain gangs and things, but they say, well, you know, go and live in the land and drink the wine and eat the summer fruits. And you're like, what? You know, it's not what you could predict with your own tiny mind.
Dr. Firth referred to a book earlier in the conversation that is called The Bible and Mental Health, in which she has a chapter on Jeremiah. Next week, I ask her about the experience of dealing with COVID-19 and this global pandemic and how that changed or enhanced what she thought or understood about Jeremiah. And she said,
the thing that connected for me in the pandemic was the isolation of Jeremiah. That sense of Jeremiah socially isolated at first, even though he wasn't actually in a jail, and then for the second part of his life in a jail, that really resonated for me. And I find that so poignant that he was so isolated humanly because he was rejected, and just physically because he was like in the well, though, you know, some of that was quite short, but some, the house arrest went on for quite a while.
And we will talk more about that next week. Until then, maybe you can read some of the book of Jeremiah and let me know if you notice a change in personality expressed in Jeremiah's writings from the beginning to the end of the book. You know, that internal versus external view of Jeremiah. The ability to bring these conversations to you is possible through my team on Patreon. People like Pastor Jack and the Sion family make this podcast sustainable and commercial-free for all of you. If you want to be a part of the same Patreon team, you'll find a link in the episode notes of the show. As always, it is wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you at this virtual table. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound creates all the amazing music you hear, and I look forward to our conversation next week. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.